Welcome to Session 361, The Book of Mormon and the Myth of the Frontier. Our presenter is Christopher Smith. He is a PhD candidate in Religions of North America at Claremont Graduate University. He's currently living in Sacramento while finishing up a dissertation on early Mormon conceptions of American Indians. His articles on Mormon history have been published in a variety of journals, including Dialogue, Sunstone, and the John Whitmer Journal. I just want to remind everyone to turn off your cell phones. The session's being recorded. And remind you to visit the book room, since Sunstone earns a portion of the sales. And we'll get started.
Hey, thank you all for coming out. I see lots of friends in the audience. Some of you don't know you're my friends yet, but you're friends in waiting, so come up and talk to me afterward and we can formalize our relationship. The Book of Mormon is a myth about the religious meaning of America. Like any good myth, it drew heavily on the myths that came before it. For instance, the idea that America is Israel, that the New Jerusalem will be in America, that we defend our land and families under a standard of liberty. These nationalist tropes were around long before they appeared in the Book of Mormon. One mythic tradition the Book of Mormon leans heavily on is what I'll call the myth of the frontier. Of course, the word frontier never actually appears in the Book of Mormon, but the idea of the frontier, the mythological structure of the frontier, is writ large in the Book of Mormon text. The frontier is the interface between civilization and the wilderness. These two are constantly juxtaposed in the Book of Mormon, and a lot of the book's action takes place as a kind of movement or interaction between the two. This interaction is the central preoccupation of the myth of the frontier. In the myth of the frontier, the figure of the pioneer comes out of a civilized metropolis into the borders of the wilderness, to borrow a Book of Mormon phrase, and here he creates a space which is neither metropolis nor wilderness. It's a transitional space. A space that is being converted from wilderness to civilization, to part of the metropolis. This space is the frontier. The betweenness of this space, of the frontier, created a constant tension and contrast that fascinated Americans, inspired the American imagination, and that became a central part of their sense of identity. Americans usually identified more with the metropolis than with the wilderness. They saw the wilderness as something to be civilized, something to be conquered, tamed, or transformed. But the process of conquering the wilderness was seen as a sort of spiritually invigorating force for the nation. The opposition from the wilderness forced Americans to sustain a kind of pioneer energy, which was what made America, with its seemingly endless frontier, seem exceptional. The myth of the frontier, I should say, was pervasive in 19th century America. The most famous examples may be James Fenimore Cooper's novels, including The Last of the Mohicans, which you have probably seen a film adaptation of. But the Book of Mormon, I think, embodies the myth of the frontier in a particularly Puritan form. So it's a slightly older version of the myth of the frontier. And this is basically because Joseph Smith is from New England, and his regional culture was deeply steeped in the Puritan tradition. And I'll say a little bit more about this later. Both the Book of Mormon and the story of Puritan settlement of America begin with an errand into the wilderness. This phrase is taken from a sermon by a Puritan minister named Samuel Danforth. Jeremy Belknap, another minister in the Congregationalist tradition, which was sort of the heirs of the Puritans in the subsequent centuries, post-colonial era, summarized, "Our virtuous ancestors fled from the impositions and persecutions to which they were subjected in England and found in this wilderness an asylum from that tyranny." In America, the Puritans hoped to construct an ideal society, a city on a hill, that would shine forth as an example to all the world. In the Book of Mormon, God warns Lehi in a dream to flee into the wilderness to escape the destruction of Jerusalem. One long wilderness journey and an ocean crossing later, the Lehites arrive in the Promised Land and start to build a new and righteous society. The Book of Mormon, in fact, recycles this trope over and over. After Lehi dies, his son Nephi is forced to flee again into the wilderness with his followers and start over again. Mosiah, Mulek, Alma, the brother of Jared. Again and again, the righteous characters in the Book of Mormon take refuge in the wilderness and found new societies there. I remember the first time I ever read the Book of Mormon. I got to Alma and I thought, man, is this the only way God knows how to solve a problem? I mean, at some point, it starts to seem almost excessive. So really, the Book of Mormon is taking this founding narrative of Puritan society, and it's raising it to the nth degree. It's running with it. It turns it into a kind of dispensational pattern that's repeated over and over again throughout history. The model, of course, for both the Puritan and the Lehite errands into the wilderness is the biblical Exodus. In the Exodus story, God delivers the Israelites from slavery in Egypt and calls them to journey through the wilderness to a promised land. In some ways, the wilderness is a place of liberation for them. They're free from Egyptian slavery. God is directly guiding them and providing for them in the wilderness. But it's also a place of suffering, temptation, and trial. The Israelites backslide. They're constantly murmuring against Moses. Some of them want to return to Egypt and go back to slavery. It would be better than wandering in this God-forsaken wilderness, as they saw it. Some of them want to turn the God-forsaken wilderness into a non-God-forsaken wilderness by worshiping idols. God is angered by this backsliding. He withdraws his guidance, and Israel wanders in the wilderness for 40 years before they're allowed to enter the promised land. The Puritans and the Book of Mormon both fully internalize this sense of the wilderness as a place of temptation. To avoid backsliding, one must constantly rededicate oneself to the community's mission. Puritan preachers railed against those who forgot the covenant, forgot their calling. They proclaimed scathing judgment against murmurers and dissenters who sundered the unity of the community. Likewise, in the Book of Mormon, the groups that journey into the wilderness are constantly troubled by murmuring and contention. Nephi's mother and brothers begin murmuring shortly after the family's departure from Jerusalem. They're tired, hungry, resentful of having to leave their comforts behind. They doubt Lehi's visions. They resent his favoritism toward Nephi. Even Lehi doubts, and he's the one who had the visions in the first place. As in the Exodus story, the family enjoys divine provision and direct guidance in the wilderness through the Liahona, but when they murmur, the Liahona stops working. They spend 8 long years tarrying in the wilderness before they're allowed to proceed to the promised land. One respect in which both the Puritans and the Book of Mormon went a little beyond the Exodus story was in seeing national Exodus as a type of the individual journey of the soul. The classic Puritan example of this is John Bunyan's novel Pilgrim's Progress, a heavy-handed allegory in which a pilgrim named Christian wanders through a wilderness landscape in search of the celestial city. Christian struggles to overcome trials and temptations that threaten to make him stray from the path. Reading the Bible is what makes it possible for him to successfully navigate this wilderness landscape. Alma in the Book of Mormon makes a similar interpretive move. He says that the Liahona was a shadow of the Word of Christ, guiding individuals on a straight course through the wilderness of life to heaven, which is the ultimate promised land of the individual soul. Thus far, the errand into the wilderness trope is not much different from the Exodus story. It's a Christian expansion of the Exodus story, but there's not much that's distinctly modern or American about what I've summarized so far, except, of course, that America is the promised land rather than Palestine. So let's talk about the ways that the Puritan and Book of Mormon stories go beyond the Exodus to become a manifestation of a specifically American myth of the frontier. The main thing is that the Puritans were preoccupied with a concept of civilization that would have been alien to the author of the Book of Exodus. The Puritans believed that God had tasked them not only to keep his commandments in the wilderness, but also to transform the wilderness by civilizing it and Christianizing it, which to the Puritan mind amounted to pretty much the same thing. You see, for the Puritans, the trappings of their civilization, including patriarchy, prudery, agriculture, literacy, technology, log houses, and white skin, became the yardstick of Christian virtue. Puritans believed they were called to be an industrious as well as a Christian people. They used this word industrious to describe themselves all the time. They believed that they had a biblical mandate rooted in the first chapter of Genesis to fill and subdue the wilderness through processes of agricultural and capitalist development. The Book of Mormon, of course, shares this ideology. The good guy civilizations of the Book of Mormon are characterized as industrious all over the Book of Mormon, as well as Christian. The very first thing the Lehites do when they arrive in their promised land is to till the earth and begin to plant seeds that they have brought with them from Jerusalem. They also search for resources to be developed, such as metal ores and domesticable animals. When Nephi describes the wild animals that they find in the wilderness, it's things like sheep and oxen and cattle and goats, domesticable animals, resources that they can exploit. They plant crops, raise flocks, process ores, build tools and buildings. They labor with their hands. Nephi's group is characterized by its religious faithfulness, its white skin, but above all by its industriousness. All of these are hallmarks of the early American concept of civilization. Counterposed to civilization in Puritan thought was its polar opposite, the wilderness. If civilization stood for God, order, peace, and the Protestant work ethic, the wilderness was demonic, disorderly, violent, dissolute. The inhabitant of the wilderness was the savage. The word savage does not appear in the Book of Mormon either, but the concept of the savage, again, is all over the Book of Mormon. Although in reality many Native American cultures were settled agricultural societies, early white settlers of America could see the Indian only as a nomadic hunter and warrior. This was the essence of the image of the savage. Adjectives commonly used to describe savage Indians in early American literature include dark, wild, filthy, naked, ferocious, bloodthirsty, lazy, idolatrous, scattered, wandering, mischievous. If these adjectives sound familiar to you, it's because all of them are also used to describe the Lamanites of the Book of Mormon. Like the savage of early American thought, the Lamanite is a nomadic hunter and warrior who lives in tents, is naked, eats nothing but raw meat. Historian Roy Harvey Pierce has written that the Indian became important for the English mind not for what he was in and of himself, but for what he showed civilized men they were not and must not be. The Lamanite serves the same function in the Book of Mormon. He's the foil against which to measure the superiority of Nephite civilization. If capitalist development was the means of Christianizing and civilizing the wilderness, missionary work was the means of Christianizing and civilizing the savage. Converting the Indians was one of the original purposes of the Massachusetts Bay and Virginia colonies. It appears in their colonial charters. And colonial founders like William Penn and Roger Williams devoted a lot of time and energy to this purpose. A Book of Mormon analog is when Ammon proselytizes the Lamanite king Limhi and has to explain basic concepts like God and heaven. And he uses the phrase Great Spirit, to describe what God is. And this, of course, is exactly how early American missionaries explained God to the native peoples. Ammon's mission is, of course, a great success, and we're told that this is evidence that God is mindful of every people, whatsoever land they may be in. This observation was necessary because early Americans were of two minds about the Indian and about his capacity for this sort of Christianization. The root problem was the confused notion of racial difference that prevailed in America at the time. Until about 1850s, race was a term that encompassed not only biology and skin color, but also culture and peoplehood. These things were conflated. And there was no clear sense of the extent to which these were biological characteristics or environmentally determined characteristics. In fact, in the Lamarckian view of inheritance in the early 19th century, acquired characteristics could be biologically inherited. So you might pass your culture on to your children, or if you spent a lot of time out in the sun and you got sunburned a lot, you might pass your dark skin on to your children. In fact, it was so there was disagreement about whether the Indian savagery was biologically inherited or merely learned, and this in turn led to disagreement about whether and to what extent the Indian was capable of Christianization and civilization. And the Book of Mormon reflects this same confusion and this same sort of double-mindedness about the Indian. Nephi tells us that the same curse that gave the Lamanites their dark skin was also the cause of their mischievous, savage hunter lifestyle. So here the Indian's savagery seems to be an inherited characteristic. Similarly, Enos tells us that the Lamanite hatred is fixed by their evil nature and that they've been unresponsive to proselytism by missionaries. But ultimately, the Book of Mormon suggests that the Indians are redeemable, indeed that they are destined to be redeemed. But it definitely reflects the early American sense that this change would be difficult. that many of the Indians will not be willing to accept the conversion. Most early Americans agreed on this much. Any Indians who could not be Christianized would have to be destroyed. Civilization and savagery could not coexist. There just wasn't room enough in this wilderness for the both of them. Richard Slotkin has written that the story of American progress and expansion often took the form of a fable of racial warfare. And because this was a war against a savage opponent, the usual rules of civilized warfare did not apply. Civilization had to use savage tactics to destroy the savage. In the Puritan tradition, this racial warfare was often described in biblical terms. Extending the analogy of the biblical Exodus, some Puritans imagined the Indians as Canaanites, Amalekites, or Philistines who had to be destroyed so that the Puritan Israelites could take possession of the Promised Land. Slotkin's phrase, a fable of racial warfare, is an apt description of at least the war chapters in Alma, if not the full story arc of the Book of Mormon. In fact, the racial warfare of the Book of Alma contains significant echoes of the biblical warfare between Israelites and Canaanites. Like the biblical Israelites, the Nephites carry on this warfare during the reign of the judges. In fact, one of the groups that Captain Moroni fights against in the Book of Alma is called the Amalekites, echoing the name of one of the ancient enemies of Israel. There are some pretty brutal slaughters in these chapters. One passage also hints at the idea that the rules of civilized warfare can be suspended in such a battle. Because civilization itself was at stake, and this was an existential struggle, Moroni thought it no sin that he should defend the Nephites by stratagem. Moroni doesn't entirely annihilate the Lamanites during this war, but he does drive them entirely out of the land northward and fortify it against reoccupation. And ultimately, this is only a stopgap measure. The endemic warfare between Book of Mormon peoples, its civilizations and its savages, comes to an end only whenever one side or the other is fully assimilated or destroyed. In early America, there was a real anxiety about what the outcome of this struggle might be. Would Europeans master the wilderness, or would the wilderness master them? One respect in which the wilderness might master them was if they themselves regressed into savagism. There was a common perception in early America that white people were becoming Indians in much larger numbers than Indians were embracing civilization. Some even claimed that whites who spent long periods of time among the Indians would begin to take on an Indian appearance, including the darkening of their skin. The renegade, the white person who went and joined the Indians, more than any other figure, signified the fragility of American civilization. One of the ways in which Americans guarded against such renegadism was through laws and taboos against racial intermarriage and intercourse. Such taboos were rooted in religious and cultural as much as racial prejudice, but racial degeneration came to function as a symbol of the decay of civilization. Renegades were frightening not only as a possible corrupting influence, but also because they combined a savage lack of restraint with civilization's capacity for technological violence. Perhaps the ultimate renegades were frontier robbers and outlaws. For instance, John Murrell's Mystic Clan reportedly hid in the Mississippi wilderness in the 1830s, plotting to incite a slave rebellion and to take advantage of the ensuing chaos to overthrow the U.S. government. Members of Murrell's group reportedly swore blood-curdling oaths during initiation and believed in the law of the jungle by which the strongest rule. This, of course, immediately suggests a comparison with the Gadiantans and the other robber bands of the Book of Mormon. The Gadiantans descend from a certain number of the dissenters from the people of Nephi who had some years before gone over unto the Lamanites, and also a certain number who were real descendants of the Lamanites, being stirred up to anger by those dissenters. Like the Lamanites, the Gadiantans hide in the wilderness, living off the meat of wild animals and plotting murder and plunder. But the Gadiantans are also more insidious than the Lamanites because they know how to manipulate the machinery of Nephite politics and law. The Book of Mormon also contains many other examples of Nephite dissenters joining the Lamanites or taking on savage characteristics. As in early America, intermarriage taboos are one of the many ways that such renegadism is prevented in the Book of Mormon. God curses the Lamanites with dark skin so that they might not be enticing unto the Nephite people. In the end, renegadism and racial degeneration play an even bigger role than warfare in the destruction of Nephite civilization. Moroni complains that many of his people have defected, and that even those who remain are without civilization. Yes, the Book of Mormon actually uses the word civilization. The Book of Mormon takes this motif to an extreme, but the anxiety that civilization might take on savage characteristics through defection or through corruption was an anxiety that many Americans in the 19th century shared. There was also some doubt, especially in the colonial era, about whether white civilization could hold out against Indian violence. The early Puritans felt completely surrounded by the wilderness and vastly outnumbered by the savages. Puritan ministers warned in their Jeremiads that God would use the Indians to punish the Puritan civilization if it didn't remain faithful to its covenants. Lack of repentance might even result in their total destruction and replacement by another civilization. This attitude was much less common by the 19th century when the national culture was moving away from religious explanations for the success of civilization and toward a scientific racism and a view that the Anglo-Saxon race had a manifest destiny to rule the world. For a large majority of 19th century Americans, the triumph of white civilization over the Indians was a foregone conclusion. The Book of Mormon, if anything, argues the opposite. Like the early American colonists, the Book of Mormon's Nephites are surrounded on all sides by wilderness infested with vast numbers of Lamanites. They are intensely aware that their survival depends on their faithfulness, and that unfaithfulness will be punished with destruction. And in the end, the Nephites actually are completely destroyed, just like the Jaredites before them. Only savages survive, and depopulated cities revert to wilderness as wild beasts move in to feast upon the corpses. American civilization in the Book of Mormon is likely similarly doomed. Unless America repents, the Lamanites, quote, shall go forth among you as a lion and tear you in pieces, and there is none to deliver. This may be the Book of Mormon's most distinctive feature in its 19th century context. The Book of Mormon's perspective is far removed from that of Jacksonian America. It's much more similar to the perspective of the colonial Puritans. Of course, the fact that the Book of Mormon reflected a Puritan rather than a Jacksonian Democrat perspective isn't terribly surprising, because the Joseph Smith family hailed from New England, as I said, a region steeped in the Puritan tradition. Yankee religious and political culture were still deeply suspicious of Jacksonian imperialism and the scientific racism that were gaining credence in national politics. New England editorialists wrote some fairly scathing critiques of Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy as the debate was happening in the 1820s. They wanted to civilize the Indians, and they believed that the Cherokee really were the symbol of the fact that Indians could be civilized. And in fact, the Smiths, who were religious sectarians and really quite poor, were even more alienated from the nation than other Yankees. Joseph Smith's lack of faith in inevitable national progress was thus fairly radical even for New England, but it was hardly unprecedented. Like a Puritan Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he held to a cyclical view of the rise and fall of civilization. He may have been inspired by the mounds, fortifications, and artifacts that he saw around New York, which seemed to imply that civilization had failed here before and might fail here again. The main antidote to such failure is repentance and Christian faithfulness, and the best guarantor of faithfulness is the Book of Mormon itself. Like the protagonist of Pilgrim's Progress, whose successful navigation of the wilderness is made possible by his constant reading of the Bible, the faithful Nephites of the Book of Mormon seem obsessed with scriptural records and literacy. Lehi's family is not allowed to go into the wilderness until Nephi obtains the brass plates. This fascination with the written word has roots in Protestant biblicism, but also in the modern era, in the Enlightenment belief that writing made possible the preservation of knowledge, passing knowledge on from one generation to another, and the achievement of higher forms of social organization, such as a code of laws. The records that the Jaredites and the Nephites bring into the wilderness seem to signify the essence of Christian civilization. They are bringing civilization with them into the wilderness. The interpreters and the Sword of Laban are also significant. The interpreters help prevent stagnation by providing a constant input of revelation into the culture. And the sword of Laban represents the redemptive state violence necessary to make the wilderness safe for civilization. So to summarize, the Book of Mormon reflects the myth of the frontier in a basically Puritan version. It shares the early American fascination with the productive tension between civilization and the wilderness as an explanation of America's distinctive meaning and identity. It replicates the early American confidence in civilization's superiority to savagery and the early American anxiety about the outcome of the struggle between the two. In good Puritan fashion, it took its lessons about how to guarantee civilization's victory from the biblical story of the Exodus. So what? What are the implications of these findings? On one level, I think this, of course, can function in the classic critique of the Book of Mormon tradition. It shows that the Book of Mormon was rooted in 19th century mythology that in some ways was, you know, fairly problematic. But I want to suggest a slightly different way of looking at this, because I think it's inevitable that any significant mythic narrative is going to be firmly rooted in the prior mythologies of its day and the beliefs of its intended audience. That's how mythic narratives get their aura of truthiness. They strike us as true precisely because they evoke our deepest implicit beliefs and our values, our unconscious values. We recognize them when we read them. They strike us as timeless and universal because we've heard them before in other versions. So in finding the myth of the frontier in the Book of Mormon, I am partly critiquing its aura of timeless power by showing that it's not actually timeless at all, but I'm also and that it's rooted in a particular time and place. But I'm also supplying an explanation for that power. And I think this is equally important. The Book of Mormon was appealing to Americans in part because it resonated so deeply with their sense of themselves as a people forging a Christian civilization from the savage wilderness. Another thing this finding can tell us is why the early Mormons migrated as often as they did and why they structured it in such a highly organized way, structured their migrations. Early Mormon migrants followed the example of the family of Lehi, not only in fleeing the wilderness to escape persecution, but also in doing so in ways which deliberately evoked the biblical story of Exodus. An example is the migration of Kirtland Camp in 1838. By the time the camp departed, the conflict in Kirtland had actually mostly died down. They didn't really need to leave. They could easily have resolved their differences with the dissenters through diplomacy. So there was no practical reason. Well, I suppose a lot of them had debts and they were fleeing creditors, but they didn't have to leave. And there was also no practical reason they all had to go at once. They went in a company of 500 people. And a lot of people advised the leaders that this was a bad idea because a group of 500 people can't forage enough food in order to feed a company of that size. So if they all went individually, they would be much more likely to be able to support themselves on the way without bringing a huge amount of resources with them. But they chose to emigrate in a company. They organized their camp on Israelite principles, and it's noteworthy they spent a lot of time disciplining murmurers, and they constantly used that word, murmurers. Everything that went wrong on the trail was the fault of murmurers. Later, of course, they do the same thing when they travel from Illinois to Utah. They call themselves the Camp of Israel. They spend a lot of time disciplining murmurers, and they organize themselves in the camp on an Israelite model. The Book of Mormon helps provide an explanation for this behavior. Mormons saw themselves as following a timeless divine pattern that had been played out many times before. I think the Book of Mormon also helps explain why Mormons' sense of themselves as a pioneering people has been so enduring. Americans, of course, have long regarded themselves as a pioneering people, but for most Americans that sense has faded over time. The frontier is now closed, and the memory of that is fading. The importance of pioneer stories is fading for most Americans. But for Mormons, it has remained a powerful source of identity. And I think that the pioneer stories and the way that they were structured on an Israelite model and the Book of Mormon and its fascination with the wilderness and the frontier reinforce each other. So the myth of the frontier was originally borrowed by Joseph Smith from the national culture, but its codification in the Book of Mormon has made it a permanent part of Mormon identity. Thank you. Now I guess we'll take comments and questions. So please come up to the microphone, and you may have to speak and get really close to the mic because the volume is not very high.
I'm remembering reading, and this is going back a ways now, books about the wilderness making the connection with the female imagery. But I can't remember one really evocative book that had a picture of a mountain on the front that kind of looked like the curvy female body. Hmm. And so I'm just curious to see, you know, what you make, if anything, of the whole depiction of gender or, and, you know, how that connects into any of this discussion of kind of wildness in
sure.
your thinking.
So the literature on representations of Indians actually tends to emphasize that Indians were a symbol of masculinity. And that's largely because the image of the Indian was an image of a hunter and a warrior, and those are very... So the traditional stereotype of the Indian is a very masculine image. Of course, the white hunter types like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett really sort of take on aspects of the wilderness in addition to destroying the wilderness. They are masculine figures. I'm not sure if the association with femininity... Yeah, I'm not sure. It's something that's
and
worth looking at.
Later, that's sort of more the sort of
right.
beginning of the emphasis on biology. And
kind of 1860s, probably.
Is more a little later, probably. Yeah. Especially if you're saying Joseph goes back to church.
Chris, just a couple questions for you. So I'm wondering how you think Enos plays into this? I mean, his journey to the wilderness, transformation, he comes back. How does that maybe play into, or does it play into what you're presenting here? And then also, I'm curious to hear you talk more about Captain Moroni, because my impression of that, of Captain Moroni has always been, you know, he is the standard bearer of what a moral leader is. And so to hear you mention Captain Moroni in the same context of say a genocide, not I didn't use the word genocide, but in terms of the American genocide of Indians, like the policies of Andrew Jackson and whatnot. I'm interested to hear more about that.
Yeah. So Captain Moroni is sort of a classic stereotype. I mean, Andrew Jackson he combines the figures of the soldier, the aristocrat, and the Indian fighter, and the hunter. And this is imitated all over early American politics. You get Parson Weems, who writes George Washington's biography and casts him in exactly the same way. You get all kinds of Democratic politicians doing this, but you also get Whig politicians imitating it. Davy Crockett was a Whig, and he casts himself in the role of, you know, an Andrew Jackson type figure as well. And I think that there's an element of that still today. We still tend to glorify leaders who combine soldiery with, you know, the aristocratic sort of sensibility. And I think Captain Moroni kind of reflects this. Captain Moroni is sort of your classic soldier aristocrat. And a lot of people have suggested that Captain Moroni is modeled on George Washington. I think that's plausible, but it's just as plausible that he was modeled on Andrew Jackson. I mean, really, this is sort of like a classic type, and it doesn't necessarily have to be modeled on any one historical figure. The Enos story, to be honest with you, the details of that are not fresh in my mind, so I'm not really sure if you want to say more about
so
that.
Just his, you know, his journey into the wilderness, and then, you know, he has this, you know, experience, and then God kind of absolves him of his sin, and then he has this transformative experience in the wilderness, returns back to share that message of what he learned, which is, you know, I see, like, kind of Jesus in there with his journey to wilderness and temptation coming back, and even a little bit of John the Baptist, but not quite the same.
Well, and Joseph Smith.
Yeah.
I mean, that was another thing that I was going to say about the Captain Moroni figures, that Joseph Smith casts himself in exactly the same way. So the frontier, or the wilderness, has always been a place where people go to be close to nature, and also there was a sense that sort of it's close to the divine as well, that the divine is sort of more immediate in the wilderness than it is in civilization.
So can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
So then if that is the perception, why is civilization then held up as the standard? If it's more separate from God than the wilderness?
Yeah, well, I think God is more immediate in the wilderness, in part because the wilderness is a demonic and anarchic place, and so God, when his people are in the wilderness, he sort of comforts them and succors them through the wilderness, because they need it, because the wilderness is so harsh and such a trial and a place of suffering. But, you know, you get a mixture of different... These are also kind of different traditions. The romantic tradition is the one that really emphasizes sort of loving nature. Nature is a place of innocence and beauty. Whereas the Puritan tradition tends to demonize the wilderness much more. And I think, you know, maybe Joseph Smith has some elements of both in his thinking. You know, he goes out into the sacred grove, and that's where he has his initial revelation, his first vision. You know, so I think probably the Book of Mormon reflects more the sort of demonic image of the wilderness, but I think he probably had some sense also that the wilderness is where God is more kind of immediately encountered. Also, another point to consider there is that the Methodists like to speak of their campgrounds. You know, they go out into the forest. They like to speak of their campgrounds as natural temples. And that makes an interesting comparison with Joseph Smith having his theophany in the sacred grove. Because groves were where these camp meetings were held. So if he, you know, had encountered that sort of rhetoric, he might well have thought of it in that way.
So I'm going to try to articulate a question that I probably... I fear that I don't know enough about American history to do it well. Hopefully you get what I'm asking. How uniquely American is the frontier myth? I ask that because how did other white Europeans who settled and colonized to the South avoid some of the same things, that some of the same interpretations of that myth that Mormons obviously did?
Yeah. So there have always been sort of two images of the savage, and this dates back well before the founding of America. One was the sort of ignoble savage that appears in the Book of Mormon, who is sort of violent and deadly. And the other is the noble savage who lives in a wilderness that is a symbol of childlike innocence. It's an Edenic paradise. And so these are two fundamentally different ways of imagining the wilderness and also the savage. And the people who tended to identify with the noble savage tradition were often social reformers. These are people who kind of want to recapture some of that, want to reject some of the vices of modern civilization. And that was pretty popular in Europe. It never became all that popular in the United States. When you get noble savages in American literature, they're usually the exception that proves the rule. So, like, James Fenimore Cooper has a number of these kind of noble savage figures, but they are exceptional individuals in their communities. Most of the Indians that James Fenimore Cooper portrays are the bad Indians, the ignoble savages. In France and in Central America, I think that both the Spanish and the French found the Indians less threatening a little bit, because the Spanish found Indians who were easily exploitable because they had these top-down governance structures, and so once they were conquered, they kind of stayed conquered, and the Spanish could impose control over them very easily. And so they came to sort of imagine the Indians as childlike, innocent, blank slates who could, the Spanish could just sort of impose their Christianity on and it wouldn't be a problem. In France, in French Canada, the French were sort of so few because the land was not as conducive to agrarian, and the climate was not as conducive to agrarian exploitation. And so they developed a model that was much more cooperative with the Indians. They're sort of allying with the Indians, trading with the Indians, but not sort of colonizing and settling as much as the English did in the United States. And so just I think that the conjunction of the Indians of the United States did not have top-down governance structures that were easily exploitable, and they also were in competition with white settlers all the time, so they resisted quite a bit to the ecological destruction and the disease and the warfare that whites were bringing. And so they just sort of developed a much more negative view of the Indian, and so that, that noble savage type was not as present in the United States. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Good question. Actually, I'm binge-watching Hell on Wheels right now on Netflix, and it's fascinating. I'm so excited to see what your topic was.
Come up to the microphone so we get it on the recording.
Oh, my bad. I don't know if I want to admit that on.
You don't have to repeat
anyway,
that, but...
Is this really on?
No. Yeah, maybe switch it.
Now it's on.
There you go.
So I'm binge-watching Hell on Wheels right now on Netflix, and... I don't know if anybody knows about it, but it's post-Civil War. It's the railroad, Union Pacific, coming. And so it's fascinating to see your topic and what you were talking about, the frontier, whatever. So I'm interested. You listed off a bunch of names that were parallels to the Native Americans, you know, ferocious, filthy, violent, whatever. I can't remember your list. But why do you think that savage was not a word that was used? You know, I mean, there's an argument that Joseph is obviously kind of constructing the Book of Mormon with a 19th century, you know, a viewpoint. So I'm just curious about that. That's, I just find that kind of fascinating that that actually is not in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah. I suppose possibly he didn't want to give himself away. you know, I mean, he's writing an ancient text, and so to some degree he's at least trying to kind of use ancient terminology. So if he was maybe even peripherally aware that savage was a modern term, he might have avoided it. The DNC does use the term savage in reference to the Lamanites. But yeah, that, you know, I don't have an explanation for that really.
There seems to be a notion with the Book of Mormon that the people coming from Jerusalem were going to inhabit an empty promised land. A couple of years ago, David Anderson a paper here at Sunstone, I think he called The Secret of the Nims, the non-indigenous Mayans. And the problem being that he was trying to describe the problem that the Nephites, the Lehites, would have encountered is that, and since Mormon scholars or apologists have discovered the same problem, is that the small band of Lehites that came would have been impossible for them to construct civilization in the short period of time that they did, given the reproductive rates and their manpower. Therefore, Anderson contended as a critique or a criticism of the Book of Mormon that there was, in fact, an indigenous people that the Lehites had to incorporate and, in an almost impossible fashion, convert to their Judaism and incorporate them to do labor. And I think he published that in a later Sunstone or a dialogue article. I don't know if you were aware of that. It was really a fascinating paper he gave some time ago.
Yeah, Orson Scott Card does a similar analysis of the Mulekite story. He argues that the Mulekites actually were indigenous people, but that the Nephites come to them and they sort of construct this imaginary history for the Mulekites, and they kind of impose that on the Mulekites, which in a way is sort of what the white Americans did when they came and taught the Indians their history, right, and spoke to the Indians and told them they were Israelites. You know, I think that's I suppose, a plausible reading of the Book of Mormon if you're coming from a faith perspective. I don't think that it's there as part of the authorial intent, because I tend to take a non-historical view of the Book of Mormon that it was written in the 19th century, but I have no particular objection to reading it that way, you know, for devotional purposes. one thing that's interesting about the Jaredites is that Joseph Smith like layers two versions of the same narrative on top of each other. The Jaredite story is like a microcosm of the Nephite story. The rise and fall of Jaredite civilization echoes the rise and fall of Nephite civilization. And when the Nephites arrive in the land, they find all these ruins that show there was a Jaredite civilization here, and they find a Jaredite record on and translate it through the interpreters, which is, of course, exactly what Joseph Smith understood himself to be doing. He was looking around in America and seeing all of these ruins, finding a record of the Nephites. And I think it's meant to show that the Jaredites were supposed to be a cautionary tale to the Nephites, and the Nephites are supposed to be a cautionary tale to modern America. So I think it's like he's sort of presenting a model for what to do when you find an empty continent full of ruins where a civilization used to be. You know, he's kind of showing, let's not make the same mistake again.
I think that this myth persists to this day. I mean, it can go back all the way to our hunter-gatherer ancestors coming out of Africa and sort of, you know, leaving a place, troubles occur, trying to find a new Eden. It persists in the form of our own myth-making today, our books and movies that we make. I just saw a movie last night called Snow Piercer, which was along the same lines. Civilization has collapsed. A noble group of people struggling to find a new promised land. Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road, and other books, and other science fiction novels. You know, sort of there's a post-apocalyptic trouble, you know, the Road Warrior, Mel Gibson, and others trying to find civilization just over the hill or in some hidden place, and everybody has to sort of struggle to make it there. It's, the whole myth and ideas is very ancient, but it persists. It makes for a good story, certainly.
Yeah, and you know, I think that the opposition between settled human places and wild places has always, it's a very old myth. It's almost as old as a agrarian civilization itself. And you can find it in the Bible, for instance. The Book of Mormon version, I think, has a lot of characteristics that are very specific to white American civilization, like the white skin and, you know, the agrarian values. But yeah, I think it's much older, and of course it does persist.
So I was just looking at the abstract, the last line here, saying that the Book of Mormon narrative forges an interesting affiliation with Native Americans against the dominant white religious culture. And I think that through a lot of the examples that you use and kind of illustrating the time that Joseph Smith would have come in, he would not have necessarily been aligned with the common, you know, political thought of that time. But it seems to me that even though in the early parts of, you know, Mormon history you have moving away, that kind of fits that narrative. In more recent times, we've seen, I guess, that Mormons are super patriotic, super conservative, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that, do you think that maybe even though Mormons still emphasize the pioneer roots, that we've kind of lost this kind of overall thinking that there needs to be this frontier approach that's, you know, at odds with being purely civilized or purely wild?
Yeah, I mean, Mormonism is kind of no longer a radical movement. The sense of being pioneers is a backward-looking perspective. It's a memory, and it's not kind of a present perspective. So yeah, I think that that Mormonism has changed a great deal, and with kind of the closing of the frontier, one wonders how God is going to solve problems in the future when his people are persecuted. He doesn't have a wilderness to send them to anymore. Yeah, I think the answer is yes.
I actually have a follow-up question for that. So It seems to me that in addition to kind of the contrast between the wild and the civilized, that is cyclical, there's also just this idea of kind of like this pride cycle, that even if you're civilized alone, you know, you'll be you'll get lazy, you'll get prideful, whatever, and that you'll bring your own downfall. So do you think that there needs to be an external, wild, savage group that opposes us, or can we come to see that like there's a dark side within our own civilization, our own structures?
I definitely don't think that we need to have the image of the savage to sort of regenerate our civilization. That's the myth of the frontier. That's not something that I subscribe to, just so everyone is clear. Although I do think that we sort of tend to create savages in every era, right? I mean, I think lately the favorite savages, not, I'm not calling them savages, but other people sort of consider themselves savages, are the Muslims of the Middle East. You know, they sort of all get conflated into this terrorist, primitivistic kind of stereotype. And so I think that that's something that we need to guard against in ourselves, not to look for savages in order to regenerate our civilization, but actually to, that's a cause of the degeneration of our civilization, is when we find savages behind every corner. I think that keeping a civilization alive, keeping it free, certainly requires vigilance, and you certainly have to be on the lookout and on the guard against things that are dark in your own culture, in your own civilization. So, the opposition in all things, I think there's some truth to that idea. Right?
This question...
I have to switch it.
This question doesn't directly deal with your main topic here, but when you talk about opposition in all things, I'm just curious. I know that there's been people talk a lot about progress and achieving success, and oftentimes there's this tie between how righteous you are and the success that you may see. And to me, it seems interesting that we have opposition in all things, but it creates kind of, I think, this false dichotomy of this simplistic view that it's either good or bad, it's black or it's white. And so to me, it seems to continue to push us in the direction of right and wrong, separation, you're there, I'm here. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are in terms of, current Mormon culture and how that adds to separation in terms of they're here, we're right, they're wrong, we're the only true, they're over there, we're the white and delightsome, they're the dark and savage, and kind of to that thought, if you don't mind.
Well, there are trade-offs. If you recognize gray areas, I think you're sort of much better equipped to behave morally, especially toward others who don't sort of fit within your cultural paradigm. But then the black and white worldview is very energizing. It does tend to motivate action. There's a reason that Fox News has the high ratings that it does. It's because it tends to adopt that sort of perspective and to energize its viewership and its audience. And I think that, of course, politicians on both sides do that and take advantage of that by sort of stirring up fear. And so, I think that we sort of always do need something to strive against and fight against. I would just want us to be as nuanced as possible in doing that, and to pick on things that are not, to fight against things that are not people, to not sort of cast people into stereotypes, negative stereotypes, and tackle corruption and not groups, specific groups that we consider to be corruptors. Well, if there are no further questions, thank you everybody for coming, and have a good day.